All right, folks, welcome back to the Game Trail Podcast. It's been a few weeks. I spent a week or so up to the Western Hunting Expo, where I got a chance to talk to my guest today. So I'm excited to have a guest on today. I've been a fan of their broadheads for the last few years. So I wanted to get a chance to talk to this individual. His name's Casey Davies. Davies? Did I get that right?
Yep. Davies.
Yep. So I wanted to get a chance to talk to Casey, talk broadheads, talk arrows. He works there for Sever. I want to get to know him better. Also do a run through on arrows and broadheads. Broadheads is always hotly contested, which I'm sure he'll have an opinion on. I mean, if you want to get into the depths of what people think about something and how mean people can be on the internet, dive into the topic of arrows and broadheads. It seems to be one of the subjects within hunting that people just love to really go all in on, and it's either their way or the highway. So it'll be interesting to talk to him about that. But before I get started, I wanted to hit you guys with a promo. You guys can use the promo code GAMETRAIL. That's just GAMETRAIL if you want to sign up for a Go Hunt Insider account. If you use that promo code, you're going to get $50 back into the Go Hunt gear shop. That's $50 you can use towards the purchase of any equipment that we carry in the shop. Also, if you're already a member, you can use that same promo code. You're going to get 10% off of most equipment in the gear shop. Also, shout out to Matthews. Matthews is a sponsor of the podcast. You probably shoot a Hoyt, though, I bet, don't you?
Used to be a Matthews guy through and through until I started working with Easton. So,
fair enough.
Yeah.
No, Hoyt makes a good bow. It's interesting. So if you listen to Cam Haynes' podcast ever, I think his ad read for Hoyt is genuinely pretty brilliant, basically saying he doesn't care what bow you shoot as long as you're shooting a bow, which I agree with. Pick up a bow and arrow and shoot it. It's an absolute blast. But I do have a lot of confidence in my Matthews bow, and I wanted to shout out those guys. I think they make a great product, and they've been really kind to me. Also, just shout them out as a sponsor of my podcast. So shout out Matthews, and we'll have to get together sometime and go head to head. We'll see if the Hoyt or the Matthews can run out.
We'll see on that one. We'll see.
So how you been? Things good?
Things are great. Yeah. Getting married this year. So hunt plans got a little screwed up. So. I told her no September.
Yeah.
How old am I? I'm 31 now. So I just turned 31 last week or 2 weeks ago.
Perfect.
But getting married in November. We're actually getting married down in St. George at Sand Hall Golf Course. So that should be fun. Other than that, just getting ready for season. We're hitting show season. So I'm heading to Iowa next week and then Illinois the week after that. So
gotcha.
It's going to be a lot of traveling around. So
yeah, absolutely. You, you don't want to get married in September. That's a hard
no.
No. Yeah, that was definitely a consideration. And then also my kids. I was just like, no, I can't have a kid in September. I have
whatever 9 months is before that.
Yeah, I have one kid. His birthday is in November, and I've missed his birthday, I want to say, probably 3 or 4 times because I've had late season hunts. Mm-hmm. And my birthday is in November, and I love those late archery elk hunts in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And there's been a number of years where I've spent my birthday and Thanksgiving by myself in Arizona chasing elk. So
honestly, I wouldn't have any other way if it was you, if it was me, you know.
I keep telling my wife, I'm like, you know, specifically for Thanksgiving, I always tell her, I'm like, you know, if I'm thinking about things I'm grateful for, like I'm certainly grateful for my family and it's good to be together with your family for Thanksgiving, but above and beyond that, there are like few things that I'm truly grateful for beyond bow hunting and, you know, elk hunting specifically. So, I mean, I think it's fitting that I get to spend Thanksgiving in the woods hunting elk.
100%. I agree on that. That's the crappy part about my birthday being in February. It's like, it's just cold and dark and gross and nothing to do. So
for sure. So where are you from originally? Are you from Utah?
Yep. So born and raised here, just in the south end of the valley. So South Jordan, Utah. Stayed in the same house from day I was born till day I moved out when I was 18. So,
gotcha.
Love to hunt. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, did you go to school here in Utah?
University? Yeah. So I went to Bing. I actually didn't go to college. I went to Snow for 1 year. Mm-hmm. Absolutely hated it. Cause I hate sitting still for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And so I just went and picked up a job at Shields just to figure out what I was doing. And then I ended up there for 11 years. So,
You're at Shields for 11 years.
Yep. Gotcha. So started there when I was 19. Started working with Dustin Whitwer. I don't know if you know who he is.
For sure.
So he was the archery manager at the time, and I was rifle hunter through and through growing up as a kid. You know, you do the 1 week a year and that was it, but it was the best week of the year. And I just wanted more opportunities to hunt. And so Dustin's like, well, you should get into archery. And so he started teaching me and getting me into it, and honestly got me off on the right foot. And then for some reason he trusted me enough to make me his full-time bow tech there. And so I got to work directly underneath him for about a year, and then he took off and started doing his own thing. But yeah, Shields was kind of my gateway into archery for sure.
It's funny, isn't it, that you have most people I talk to, myself included, you typically have some interest in hunting, but then some individual just like gets a hold of you at the right time and kind of gets in your head the idea of archery and archery hunting. And takes root. You start to fiddle around with it a little bit, and then usually within that first encounter, you know, you're fully hooked.
Yeah.
And
well, I just went with a buddy that was bow hunting that same year that Dustin was kind of talking to me. I was like, I just want to go with you. And the amount of deer we saw, the amount of bucks we saw, I was like, this is way better than rifle hunting. And so, I mean, from then on, I've been hooked. I haven't been rifle deer hunting since. So,
yeah, I had the same experience. I came back from a mission, LDS mission. I came home, and I was always going to be a dentist is what I thought I was going to be. And then when I was in England, and the thing that I missed the most, I think I was telling you at the expo, but the thing I missed the most was just the outdoors and open space in the mountains. And came home and I thought, I can't be a dentist. And so I went to work for the Forest Service. And the first year I went to work for the Forest Service, I had a buddy that was working the same trail crew. And my dad had always bow hunted, but then this buddy of mine, he was big into archery and big into bow hunting. And I was out all the time, and I was seeing animals in the summer, you know, and those deer red coats, they show up really well on a hillside. And I was like, man, there's deer all over. You know, this is not the same experience I have in late October when I go rifle hunting. And yeah, he just like planted that seed, like, oh, you should get into bow hunting maybe. And yeah, started tinkering with the idea and just thinking, oh, maybe I could do that. And then it just picked up. And like, I got my dad's old bow tuned up that year. It was like an old Fred Bear compound, and I had a bunch of mismatched arrows and like a real hodgepodge sight, you know, brass pins. And yeah, just went out and started shooting, and I pretty instantaneously just fell in love with the process of shooting a bow. And it's just funny, like one person can plant the seed in your head, and just like a little bit of guidance, like take hold, and then that thing becomes like your obsession for the rest of your life.
Yeah, well, it's kind of cool being in those areas, like with Dustin, you know, rubbing shoulders with them, and guys that are willing to come and teach you those kind of things. You know, I probably bugged the crap out of him asking all sorts of questions about backpacks and what gear to use and all that stuff. And I mean, just grateful for those mentors in my life for sure. Yeah. So
what was it like being a bow tech at a pro shop?
It was a lot. August really sucked. July and August was not a fun time of year, but the connections you'd make with people, you know, that was the part I loved the most, was like, you'd tune somebody's bow up, it wasn't shooting good, they would go start getting confidence in it. And then they'd come back in September or October and be like, hey, look at this deer I shot, or this elk I shot with the bow you set up, you know? And that was super rewarding for me. But there was moments when guys are breathing down your neck and it's 2 days before open, and they're like, why isn't my bow tuned yet? And like, you just gave it to me 2 seconds ago. I've got 50 more in front of you. So it's, you know, that was the stressful part. But being in the shop and tinkering and, you know, being around a bunch of like-minded people, bouncing ideas off each other, that was a ton of fun too.
Did you end up doing like a lot of coaching as well? Because I would assume you probably get a chance to look a lot of different people shoot bows, and probably pretty quick you can say, hey, maybe try this, do that.
Yeah, a little bit here and there. It just depends on if the guy's ego would let you coach him, because you'd get the old boy in there that's been shooting a bow for 30 years, but he grips his bow like this and it's a death grip and he's mashing his face against the string, and there's nothing you can tell that guy that he's going to fix it because he's been doing it that way for 30 years. But
right.
The guys that were receptive of it, you know, step in and like, hey, can I show you proper anchor points? Can I show you how to, you know, get your nose on the string to make sure the peep lines up and stuff like that? So,
yeah,
I mean, that was a ton of fun.
Yeah. How many arrows did you fletch there, you think? A lot?
There was nights I would get, or weeks I would get like 10 to 15 hours of overtime just fletching arrows. I'd get done with my shift covering the bench, and then I would go back and fletch arrows for 10 to 15 extra hours throughout the week.
Yeah,
but I just, and like Now I don't even fletch my own arrows. So really? It's just, I have my buddy Sawyer. He works for Kyle Douglas. I think I was right. talking to you about him. Yep. Yeah, I just give it to him. It's like, he loves doing it. So mm-hmm. it's like, I trust his work. Might as well let him do it. Because I just fletched probably hundreds of dozens throughout the years. And it's just old to me now. So yeah. It's not the fun, exciting thing.
I was in my local pro shop yesterday. I just ran up just to poke around. I had some free time. And so I thought, oh, I've been into the local shop for a minute. I ran up and I was asking those guys about business and how it's going, trends and, you know, bow sales and what they kind of see the most of going in and out the door. And then we got on the topic of like busy season and they basically said the same thing, but I was asking them, you know, does it get really busy right up until the hunt? And he's like, man, we'll have guys walk in literally the day before the opener, you know, and they'll want a dozen arrows put together. He's like, and then even during, you know, during the season, he's like, we'll have 10, 15 guys come in that'll need a new string. Like mm-hmm. it'll be 2 or 3 days into the season and they'll come in and they'll have a, you know, a bow that's derailed. They'll need a new string or new cables. And I was asking them, I'm like, what kind of issues are people having with strings? And he's like, man, we've seen everything. Like we've seen guys run broadheads across strings. We've seen mm-hmm. guys, you know, go to full draw on an animal and, you know, not be able to get a shot off and they'll try to let down and they'll roll a stick into their cam, you know, between their cam and their string and, you know, roll the string off the cam and pop it off and,
yep.
you know, defect a limb. Did you see a lot of that?
Dude, it was bad. Like, really? So I would work opening weekend most of the time. Cause I hate going out on the opener sometimes. Yeah. Cause it's just a zoo. Second weekend, I usually have better success on anyway. So I'd work the opener so I could get the later parts off, but you get guys running in there like, we'd open at 9:30. You'd get guys in there at 9:35 they're like, I was just in a tree stand up on the Wasatch this morning. I dropped my bow. It blew apart. Can you put it back together? It's just like, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you'd see some of those, like the broadheads against the string was more than you imagine. Actually, I think guys just get fired up and they pull an arrow out of their quiver and they just run it across there.
Yep.
And so, I mean, you'd see just about everything. I saw a guy run over his bow one time. Which, speaking of Matthews, they were a really good company. They ended up hooking him up. They shouldn't have. It was the guy just ran over his bow accidentally. And I called my rep, Tom, at Matthews and was like, hey, this guy screwed up. And he's like, I'll sell him one for our cost. So it was like, whatever it is, some ridiculously cheap price. But just going above and beyond, just giving a plug for Matthews there. So
yeah, I've never ran over a bow. I ran over a spotting scope one time. I had a spotting scope leaned on a tripod against my back wheel and just was dead tired at the end of a day shed hunting and just jumped, thought I had all my gear in the truck and backed over it was a Vortex spotter, which was great.
Oh, luckily it's a Vortex.
yeah. Luckily it was Vortex, but I've never ran over a bow, but I can see people doing it for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it crushed it too. He had like a spot hog sight on there, tight spot quiver. I mean, everything was just folded in,
mashed.
Yeah, I think he had a diesel truck and he just put his case in front of his tire and he just forgot to put it in the bed of his truck. And
man, wouldn't you just be gutted? Oh, that would be the worst.
And that was the thing, the guy was just heartbroken on it, and the fact that we were able to get him taken care of that day, I mean, he was just super stoked about it. But
yeah,
that's my favorite part. I love taking care of people. Like somebody calls in the sever, like I overnighted some heads to a guy in Colorado who showed up and his heads weren't in his case. So I overnighted some heads to Colorado. He shot a deer that next day with it. Actually stopped by the expo and showed me a picture of it. Was super stoked. So
that's awesome.
But
have you ever had anything like that happen to you personally? Have you ever had any equipment fail on you in the field?
No, I actually have not. I've only had a release fail once, up at TAC a couple years ago. I had I won't name the release, but it was a wrist strap release and I was going to full draw and it popped, but that was the only like mishap I've ever had. I always prepare for it. I have a pretty much a full archery bag in my backpack at all times, you know, D-loop, serving, all that stuff, extra peeps, all that good stuff. So
yeah.
But
yeah, I was having a discussion the other day with a guy about rest up at my local range. I was shooting and we were talking about limb driven versus cable driven, and you know, you got like a Hamsky, which is a limb driven option, which I've always touted and said, you know, if you ever have an issue with that cable, you run a broadhead across it or something like that. You could, in essence, you could fix it with an Allen wrench and a, you know, a
shoelace
if you had to. Right. And he's a QAD fan. He has a QAD on his, it's the integrated rest. And we were talking about different, accuracy and things. And, I've never had an issue with the rest. I've had an issue with the sight. Like, I showed up in Colorado on an elk hunt a few years ago, and I think it was kind of an altitude thing. I ended up doing kind of a sight in before I left, and I was shooting a 5-pin Excel, landslide. And I was like, oh, my pins are all running a little bit hot, and it felt like some of them were a little hotter than the other. I thought I'd done it due diligence and sighting the thing in, but I ended up having to make some adjustments to individual pins within the housing. And for whatever reason, like, the actual driving micro mechanism within those pins, like, wasn't working. And I ended up walking one pin to the bottom, and I couldn't get the thing to go back up. And I was at the trailhead. So I was with Neville and his brother, and I was just like, we're burning daylight. I'm like, you guys just take off. So I sent them on their way down the trail, and I ended up having to pull that whole head apart and, like, put it back
together. Oh my gosh.
And then re-sighting in. It was a complete disaster. Like, I was,
yeah,
like,
that's sounds like a joke. We kind of had something similar with my buddy in our elk hunt this year, where he just last minute string came apart, and he had to borrow his brother's bow, and it wasn't set up for him. So we were at the trailhead shooting arrows, just trying to get him used to it. I was just like, this isn't ideal. So
do you carry backup strings and cables for bows? Like, when you go into the field, anything like that?
If I start going, like, out of state, like, my plan is for, like, Colorado, I always have one I keep in my bow case.
Yep.
But I don't have a press or anything I keep with me, but just in case I needed to run into a different shop. But if I'm out of state, I will. If I'm here local, like, if I hunt the Uintas or something like that for elk, I usually don't pack anything up there because I'm going to come back here to get it restrung anyways. So,
yeah, I have gone to carrying backup cables and strings. I just keep them in my truck. And it's like you're saying, if I go to Colorado, if I go to Wyoming, I could probably drive to a local pro shop, borrow a press, and, you know, put them on if I had to.
Yeah.
Retune the thing.
Yeah. Luckily, I've never had to do any of that. I'm always a worst case scenario prepper, and I never end up having to use any of the worst case scenario prepping stuff. So
that's good. But
it's there for if I need it. So
that means you're doing it right. So you worked as a tech. I assume the whole time, you were bow hunting yourself. After you started working there as a bow tech, do you put all your time and effort into bow hunting?
Yeah. I mean, it was instant flip of a switch. It went for me, like I said, all my whole life, rifle hunting. That's all I did. Mm-hmm. Shot my first year when I was six with a 25-06 over my dad's shoulder. And then once I switched to bow hunting, I mean, I'll go on an occasional rifle cow hunt there, here and there for Utah, just to put meat in the freezer. But other than that, I won't touch a bow. Or won't touch a gun. Sorry. Yeah. Opposite. So.
Yeah. It's fun, man. It gets into your blood, and I don't know what it is. To me, the older I get, it's like, I like the earlier season because I feel like I see more animals. I felt like elk are built for bow hunting. You know, they bugle, they're a large animal. You have the interaction with them. And then, the older I get, I just don't like the cold weather as much, you know? So I don't want to deal with the snow and, like, a third season rifle hunt in Colorado. It's, 15 degrees or 10 degree daytime highs. I'm just, like, over it.
Yeah, I don't need that.
Yeah, me either.
I want summer days, 75 degrees. That's what I'm about. But
how did you get involved in Sever? Sever.
Okay, so when I was at Shields, I tried to make really good relationships with all the vendors. So once I was bow tech for a while, Dustin left. I became archery manager, kind of moved into management positions through Shields. And I had a really good connection with Tyson Yates, who's the sales manager for Easton, which not a lot of people know this, but Sever's actually owned by Easton Archery. And so I've always had a good connection with him, and I would, touch base with Tyson every so often, be like, hey, if there's ever a job in the industry, let me know. And he hit me up early last year and was like, hey, I have this position in mind. It's, he kind of roughly explained what it'd be. He's like, I just got to get it approved, but would that be something you'd be interested in? And I was like, for sure. And so 2 months later, he called me. He's like, hey, applications are open. If you want to put one in. And about a month later, after interviews, he offered me the job. But he was just like, he saw what I did with the archery shop at Shields. And he's like, I just want you to bring that same customer attention, that same drive to Sever as well, and see what you can do with it there.
Gotcha.
So
what's your official title over there? Like, what do you
do today? Yep. So I'm pretty much everything. So I'm sales manager and brand manager. I manage most of the customer service calls too. So if somebody calls in, if I'm not out doing something or hunting or whatnot, I'll answer the phone. And so it keeps me busy. You know, it's that kind of stuff. I formulate marketing schemes, what we're going to release in the next year or two. Just try to like create a vision for the brand and see where we can go with it. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. You're kind of a middle infielder then, utility player.
Yeah. So, I mean, like Easton helps me with a lot of stuff. So like our marketing lead, he's mainly Easton, but like my whole thing is like, I'm the only one there that's fully paying attention to Sever. Mm-hmm. And so it's just throwing gas onto a already going fire. So.
Right. How many employees does Sever have just dedicated to just Sever? Do you know? Is it relatively just you?
Just me, because everybody else is a split of Easton and Sever.
Gotcha.
So like our engineers that design the heads, they're actually the ones who design like the Easton half outs, the Easton, you know, collars, the hits, inserts and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So they're dealing with all archery aspects, which is kind of cool. So you have somebody that's building the arrow that's also building the broadhead. So you're going to get that matchup. That's why I think we have such good success with our accuracy is
right.
We're pairing the two together there.
Mm-hmm.
So. But yeah, I'm the only dedicated, fully dedicated Sever employee.
Man, you're a busy dude then, I would assume.
Yeah. Right now it's a little slow, but like, yeah. Again, it takes me back to my archery shop days, July and August, September mm-hmm. was a lot. I mean, it was just phone was ringing constantly, nonstop, just people asking about heads and whatnot. So.
For sure. Do you know, what's the history of Sever as far as the design? Like how long you guys been around? Where did the design come from? What makes you guys different than other mechanicals? And then we'll dive in eventually. I want to have a little discussion of why mechanicals and then different mechanicals. So mechanicals like yours that are kind of a slip, right? So they slip mm-hmm. back within the ferrule versus something like a Grim Reaper that's a fold back, right?
Yep. The jackknife style.
Yeah, jackknife. Is that what you call it?
That's what I call it. That's what I've always called it. But I mean, there's probably another technical term for it.
Yeah, I always call them fold back. But yeah, that's. I want to have that discussion as well. And then I also just want to talk mechanicals kind of versus a fixed blade in general. But where does the design come from? Where did that develop?
Yeah, so the Ulmers, so the Ulmer brothers, everybody thinks it was just Randy, but it was his brother Rusty, who's the kind of brains behind the broadhead. But Randy was a competition shooter forever.
Yep.
His thrive for accuracy, he wanted to shoot mule deer at a long range, because, I mean, that was his stick for a long time. He'd always kill big mule deer at some ridiculous 70 to 100 yards, it felt like. And so they designed the broadhead that matched his field points, because he was always frustrated. He's like, I'd be accurate as all get out with field points, and then I switch to broadheads and I can't hit the broadside of a barn. Mm-hmm. And so his brother Rusty engineered the head to be streamlined, have the blades hidden inside the ferrule to get that field point accuracy out of it. Well, they ran that for 5 or 6 years. I don't remember how long it was, but it was under the Ulmer Edge, which I think Trophy Taker was the ownership of it. And then I think they just got kind of sick of it, and they offered it to Easton. So Easton picked up the patent for the lock and pivot and the practice lock and some of the other few patents that they had. And they bought that in 2016 and slightly redesigned it, moved from an aluminum to a titanium ferrule, which just adds durability. Tried going to retail. Everybody told us to go pound sand. So we decided to do direct to consumer. Yeah, that's the story. So I wasn't there, obviously wasn't there, but you know, the guys that kind of got Sever rolling, they were like, yeah, we tried taking this thing to retail and nobody really wanted to latch onto it. They were just like, that thing will just be gone in a couple of years. Nobody wants that.
That's
and
really
so
interesting because my memory, obviously I'm a microcosm of, you know, the greater demographic, but I remember the Ulmer Edge and I mm-hmm. had Ulmer Edge and I really liked them. I thought they flew great. They made sense as far as design goes. And I remember when they kind of discontinued and they went away, like I remember going through and like different archery forums, Archery Talk, for example, guys were trying to find and buy and like stockpile Ulmer Edge broadheads because they love the broadhead. They love the design mm-hmm. of it. And people were kind of bummed out when it went away. So I would have thought that like people would have been like, hey, yeah, hell yeah, let's get them back in shops.
Yeah, I was going to say you'd think, but that at that time, I mean, I think Rage was still a big hit. And it's before Rage started to lose a little bit of the reputation. So it was just, for some reason, they just didn't want to latch onto us. And so our guys at Sever at the time, that was the Easton employees, they just wanted to see what they could do with it. So they tinkered with the kind of QU method, which is that direct consumer. Yep. So, and it's honestly done really well for us.
Mm-hmm.
we're eventually looking to go to retail, but I mean, for right now, we're still growing organically without having to push into a retail front. So
gotcha. Where do you guys, where are they made? Do you make them in the States? Are they made overseas?
We make all the initial runs here in the States, just because we have machines here that can do it. But for like high production, we actually do it overseas just because of our cost. Yep. If we wanted our heads to be $35 a piece, we would do it here in the States. It's the nature of the beast, but everything's designed, tested. When they come across, we take one out of every box. We spot check every single box that comes through, do a durability test, do a quality check on it. So,
yeah. Yeah. And that's not a knock to you guys by any means. I mean, I understand the name of the game. Our product at Gohan, I mean, a lot of it's made overseas. Like it's kind of the nature of the beast. I get it, but I did want to ask the question primarily because I know people will ask, they ask me.
Oh, 100%. And that's kind of the tough part is I wish we were, but it's one of those things that's, I'd rather provide a quality broadhead for a decent price than tout American made and try to, you know, beat my chest for that and have an expensive broadhead. So yeah.
You might have some insight into this. I wanted to ask you. So I know Easton, a lot of people say like, oh, Easton Arrows American made. How many versions of Easton Arrows are actually American made? Are they all made in America, or is it like your top end line, like the X10 Parallel Pros and
kind of so upper end? All of our hunting arrows are made in the USA. So they're actually made just right here in Salt Lake. X10's made in Salt Lake as well. Some of the only ones that aren't is like the Super Drives. So our carbon target shafts, those are made overseas. But any large carbon shaft, it's hard for our method of pultrusion to make that big of a shaft. But everything aluminum we do here. So all the, you know, X27s, all your target arrows for like Vegas and whatnot, those are all going to be made here in the United States. So yeah, it's a very small amount. We have the components machined overseas just because there's so many of them. But as far as the arrows made, I mean, it's kind of crazy. You go back into the factory and they're just sitting there just pumping arrows off all day, every day. It's just crazy.
And that's even like your new 5mm carbon. Those are made. And is that relatively new? Because I thought at one point, like your carbons were made somewhere else, and then like your aluminum line, and then like your X10s were made
A long time ago. But since Easton bought Beeman out and moved the pultrusion machines from France over here to the United States, everything's been stateside since then. So, yeah.
Gotcha.
But like these are being made. These are the 5.0s.
Yeah.
These are just being ripped out as fast as we can freaking make them right now. So.
Yeah, I've had more questions about those than just about any arrow I can remember in recent memory.
Yeah, you know, it's a great arrow. It's very similar to the Victory. I forget. I think it's the Rip TKO, or is it the?
They have a new one called the LR.
HSLR.
Yeah, HSLR. Yeah.
But this one was to copy that Victory. That was that, you know, 8.2 grains per inch at that 300 spine, because we were just getting asked for that. Guys were like, I love the axis. It's a little too heavy. You know, you're running those, they're pushing up into that 480 range at a 300 spine. And so guys weren't wanting to run them because it was just too dang heavy. And so they developed this just to kind of get that lighter weight 5mm shaft. But
it's interesting, isn't it? It like archery it's not different than probably any other industry, I guess. And as I think about it, but man, we have these trends, right? Where we go, oh, you have to shoot a 500 grain arrow to hunt elk, you know, and you need FOC of 15 to 20% plus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then now this year, I would say arguably the two hottest arrows on the market are, you know, the Victory, new Victory, and then the Easton 5.0, right? Which is a lightweight 5mm arrow.
Yeah. It's
just interesting how it goes. I mean, I've seen people that, you know, swore up and down to my face that you needed a 480 to 550 grain arrow to hunt elk that are now shooting a 420 grain arrow or a 430 grain arrow. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
It's really interesting to me. I've never really gone one where probably the lightest arrow I would say I've shot is maybe 450 grains, maybe 440, somewhere in that neighborhood, to up to like 490, right? I've kind of been within that window. And I would say probably like the last 5 or 6 years, I've probably been 470 to 500 grains. But
it's a great number.
It's just funny how like those trends flip. And
Yeah, I saw it at the shop a lot. You know, like when I first came in, it was like when the Bowtech RPM 360 was the thing. Everybody was just like speed, 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 speed. And then it started to be like, no, we want quiet. And so then like Matthews took off. And now it's like we're kind of going back towards speed, which is, I don't know. It's just funny how it just kind of roller coasters through. So yeah.
What's your opinion? What do you shoot for an arrow? Like if you're going,
so
you're going elk hunting.
Yeah. So I'm kind of back and forth. So I did two kind of polar opposite setups this year, just cause I wanted to see how they perform. So for my elk hunt, this last year I shot the FMJ, 4mm. So super heavy arrow, shot it in a 280 spine, which I'm shooting 80 pounds. So I was like, oh, I'll just get a super heavy arrow. It was like 530 and it was going like 270. Like it was just a dog of an arrow. It did well. I mean, I don't feel like the penetration was much better on my elk than what it would have been with a lighter weight arrow. But now I'm running the 5.0s because I set these up for a coos hunt. And I think this is what I'm going to be running with going forward just because of the pin gappings on it. Mm-hmm. So shooting like the whole reason I set it up was for like 100-yard shots. Coos hunting is just, you know how it is. It's, yep. You're not going to get any closer, probably 80 yards to him. So I was like, I want as little room for error as possible. So when I draw back, if he steps a yard, I'm not going to miss because my arrow is so sinking heavy. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what I'm going to be running. I saw a bunch of guys shoot this 5.0 this last year through elk and had no issue with penetration, you know, running that 420 to like 435 grains. So I don't know. We'll see. I'll try to shoot a bull this year with it and see what I like. But before that,
are you shooting that in a 250 spine?
So this one, I bumped my bow down a little bit. I went to a 300 spine on this just for weight. Cause there was a better trade off. I got a little bit of speed reduction, but the going down to a lighter spine, getting way lighter actually made up for it. Plus some. So it made sense to go drop to 75 pounds, run a 300 spine, get a little bit lighter weight, get a little bit more speed out of it. So
what kind of draw length are you running then?
I'm a little short draw length. I'm a 28 and a half.
Okay.
So not a monster draw by any means.
Gotcha.
But I've never had any issues with penetration. Like deer I shot this year at 70 yards. I mean, it was a complete pass through. So I couldn't complain about that.
Yeah. When you're building out an arrow, how do you decide on spine? Do you use a program like Archer's Advantage or something like that? Or are you just kind of working from your knowledge of having built and set up so many different bows? And then like, what is your process? Do you buy a dozen arrows and then take one and cut it to like a length that you think is appropriate and then tune to it and then cut the rest of your arrows?
Yep. So I'll buy a dozen, start with like a baseline. So I'll start at, you know, 28 and a half, cause that's the front of my, I don't want it any longer than that. I don't like my arrow sticking out. Mm-hmm. So I'll start at 28 and I'll get it close with like the shaft selectors from like the companies. Mm-hmm. Archer's Advantage, I'll play with a little bit. It's kind of finicky sometimes. I don't know if you dink with it a lot, but
all the time. Yeah.
You have to like talk to it in a certain way to get it to do what you want it to do, yeah, which
talk to me nice.
It
needs like, you typically have to go back. So you can like put your arrows and your inputs and things in it. And then you have to always go back to the bow setup and like hit that little icon that says use. I can't remember what the actual, you know, verbiage is on the little icon, but you have to hit that button to basically export that to your setup. Anytime mm-hmm. you change anything, you have to go back and do it. Otherwise you get some funky results, but I've played with
yeah, that and they
kind of know.
They don't have all the, you know, proper weight. So you're trying to like play with tip weight to try to get it to match up with your arrow. And it just doesn't, the math doesn't math sometimes. So, yep. But I'll get it close with a spine selector and then I'll run hot melt and just see how it tunes. So I'll hot melt and insert in with a fill point. Cause then if I need to, I can just pull it, you know, cut it, shave it back a little bit more. And then usually I've been landing about 28 inches is where my arrows like to be. 27 and like 3/4 to 28 inches.
Gotcha.
Has been like my last four arrow setups, it feels like.
Your hunting arrows that you're going into the field with, like when you actually build out your dozen, what are you using to glue your inserts in? Are you using hot melt?
So for these Easton inserts, I use the two-part epoxy on it. I just think it's the better way to go. Mainly for durability reasons, because when they have that two-part epoxy, it has some rubber in it. Mm-hmm. And so for impact, it doesn't want to break that arrow. It has a little bit of kind of shock absorption to it. Versus if I've seen it happen where guys throw just super glue on a hit insert, slam that thing in there, and then it eventually breaks over time. You know, if you shoot it enough, it's going to break loose and your insert falls out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't use Hotmail for like final projects. It's just for like tinkering, stuff like that.
I've used one of my favorite is just that it's the Easton's Dr. Doug's, the orange stuff.
Mm-hmm. The instant.
Yeah. It's instant. I like instant just because, I can throw those things in and I can run out and shoot them in 20 minutes. You know what I mean?
So I jacked up $100 of arrows when I was 20 years old, like my second year bow hunting. Cause I used that pink stuff.
Sure.
I called it the devil glue for a long time, but, I had some injections at the time and I put a little dab on there and I'm like, okay, just go quick. And it would get stuck halfway through.
Yeah.
And it would just bond too quick. And so I had $100 worth of arrows that had inserts that deep in them.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I've not had that happen. I, twist them in. I usually clean the shaft, clean the insert. I'll do like a test run with it before I actually put glue on it, Mm-hmm. But when I get the glue on it, man, I'm twisting, I'm going all the way in and I'm going quick. And
yeah. The thing it's like quick
it,
too.
Yeah, it is quick. Yeah. You got to get it in. But the thing I like about it is that like I don't lose inserts ever.
Oh no, that thing's in there.
Like
that's
I don't,
in there.
You know, if you go to like our local range, they're cardboard and like cellophane backed, right? Or if you go to like if I go down to Vegas, a lot of those are those super compact carpet.
So, like, oh yeah.
They pack those things in and I'll go up there and shoot with those guys and inevitably those guys are like pulling inserts like a couple every time we go up there. I never lose inserts.
Yeah.
So it's not ideal. I don't like hot melt. It seems like it pulls out, but yeah, I mean it, I see what you're saying. You do have to get them in there quick, but man, they never come out.
No, that's just a secondary thing for the guys that didn't want the two part epoxy. Does this. So it has the rubberized stuff in there. That's a great glue. Like I said, I just don't deal with it anymore. Cause it's, I just have PTSD from it. So yeah,
no, I get that. What are you shooting for inserts? So you're shooting the Easton half outs and like what grain?
Nope. So I went with the hits on this setup this year. So I'm running the 50 grains of brass up front. Mm-hmm. And then I'm running that, just the match grade collar on it as well. Mainly just to get more durability down inside the shaft. Cause whenever you have that hit insert sitting down in there, the ferrule of the broadhead actually goes with that. So you just get deeper protection on that arrow. So, less tip breakages going through an animal and stuff like that. If you're, glancing off shoulders and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I think it's a more durable system.
Do you know total weight that you've got in the end of that?
So end of this, so it's 22 grains for the collar, 50 grains for the, insert inside there. So it's 72.
Okay.
Yeah. And then 100 grain broadhead. So I don't get too crazy on FOC. Uh-huh. I think there's too much and then there's obviously a point that you want to get to, but the guys that get FOC crazy, I don't believe in that stuff.
Do you even know where you're at as far as like percentage wise? You ever measured it to see what you're at?
Back in the day when, like, again, going back to trends, when FOC first came out, you get kind of suckered into it. So you start testing it and every guy that came into the shop wanted to know what their FOC was. So back in the day, I would play with it. I just know that this is going to be above that 13% threshold that I think is like the kind of baseline with that 50 grains of brass. So I haven't even measured this one. I'd probably guess 14.
Gotcha.
So
yeah, I don't know what mine is either. I'm shooting I think we were talking at the expo, but right now I've got some, I think they're gold tip pierces with an Easton 75 grain stainless steel aluminum mm-hmm. half out. I like that system just because it's like one piece. And
yep.
One thing I like about that is I think, I don't know if it's true or not, but I feel like I get better alignment because it is contiguous. It's like one piece, you know what I mean? So it's all machined and mm-hmm. it's like one contiguous piece. And I also like the fact that it's got those little rubber O-rings on those Easton half outs. The thing I like about that is that I can put those in the end of a shaft and I can put a field tip or a broadhead on them and I can spin those in my hand and I can move the insert around until I get perfect alignment. And mm-hmm. spin those to where they're spinning the truest. And then I'll take a silver Sharpie and I'll make a mark on the insert and the end of the shaft. And then when I actually glue those things in, I line those two marks up. So to me, that's like, I know that that's the spot in my arrow where that insert and that arrow are perfectly aligned. And since I started doing that, it used to be that I could maybe get like, if I'd buy a dozen arrows and I'd cut them from both ends and I'd square and I'd do the whole process, it felt like I could build out a dozen arrows and I might get 7 or 8 out of a dozen that like I felt like spun really well. But I feel like doing this, I feel like the shafts are pretty straight, but I feel like most often the misalignment is between the insert and the end of the arrow. And
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it feels like with that little rubber O-ring and those Eastons, which I think is genius, there's enough tension that the insert will stay in there and I can spin that thing prior to actually gluing it in. So I dig that. And since I've been doing that, I can typically get like 10, 11 arrows that are pretty damn straight.
Can't beat that. We've been toying with the idea of doing glue in broadheads. Mm-hmm. So where the inserts all connected together.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We're just trying to get the feelers out on that. So if anybody's out there listening, message me if it's a good idea, cause we can do it. So
maybe one contiguous piece, huh? Insert broadhead.
Mm-hmm. So like Iron Will does something kind of similar to it. Mm-hmm. They do the one piece, the Snyder Core systems.
Yep.
And our engineers, the guys that do the half outs and whatnot, they're just like, that's just a superior system. And they're just wanting to kind of see what it would do. So
interesting.
Just for that accuracy point. He's like, it's the most accurate system out there having a glue in. Cause it just like your point, everything's one continuous piece going through there.
Yep.
It's not connecting multiple pieces together. So,
yeah. Okay. So let's talk we'll talk broadheads now. Well, I'm curious as to, have you ever played around with the, like a broadhead that's got the foldback design?
Yeah. So I've shot a few animals with Grim Reapers specifically. Okay. They work well. I tinkered with a lot of broadheads when I was working at Shields, just because whatever new thing came in, I just wanted to play with it. So I like those Grim Reapers. The problem I have with them, and I'm not trying to talk bad on anybody's setup or anything like that, but you lose just a ton of energy when those heads, that blade's trying to whip back around. You don't have anything cutting until it hits this point.
Yep.
And so you're shooting something at a little bit longer range. All of a sudden it's taking considerable more energy to actually get that head to flip around versus ours, where it just kind of streamlines in. You don't lose any energy on that impact. Mm-hmm. So that's my one downside with it for like, especially like lower pounded shooters, guys that struggle with penetration in the first place, those style broadheads wouldn't be my first choice for them. And that's where we kind of shine, is we have, you know, kids and stuff like that run our heads, because they take so little pressure to open. Mm-hmm. They're still getting good, you know, not full pass-throughs, but they're getting decent penetration with 40, 45 pound bows. So.
Gotcha. Do you think that there's, cause you always hear, I've passed the same advice on that, you know, people that are not generating the type of kinetic energy that maybe somebody like you or I would be, where we've got longer draw lengths, more draw weight, maybe shooting a little bit heavier arrow, but typically kind of the advice to people is if you're, you know, a woman or a kid, you've got less energy, you should probably be shooting a fixed blade broadhead. Do you think there's merit to that? Or do you think that the Sever's a decent option for somebody like that?
I was going to say, there is some merit to that. I'd rather have a bigger, like a little bit bigger cut on it personally. So that's where like the Sever comes into play. Cause your biggest fixed blade broadhead is going to be, was an 1 3/16 or something like that.
Yeah, maybe.
And so having, you know, jumping up to 1.5 inches gives you that little bit more cut to it. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've seen it firsthand. We had a couple gals at Easton that they do a hog hunt every year in Florida, and they took them down there and they were getting pretty much full passers, arrows sticking out on the other side and they're shooting 35 to 40 pounds. So it's kind of one of those things, like I've seen it happen. I'm not going to say it's a guarantee every single time because it's archery, but it's something I've witnessed, and I do recommend it to some people that feel like they can do that. So.
Gotcha. I think I probably took it for granted because I'm familiar with your broadheads and I'm a fan. I've been shooting them for a number of years now and I've had good results, but maybe just for people that aren't familiar with Sever broadheads, like run us through what a Sever broadhead is. Like how does the design work?
Yeah. So the thing that makes us kind of special, like what I was saying earlier about Randy, so where the blades are hidden down inside the ferrule versus most mechanicals, you know, they're sitting out kind of like that in mid-flight. Mm-hmm. And so you have blades sticking off there that's going to obstruct your flight, add turbulence, you know, kick your arrow flight all around. So having the blades hidden inside is the first thing. So you get that field point accuracy. That was the one thing I like. Second thing, and this is honestly what got me hooked on it even before I started working for Sever, was this practice lock. So this little hole right here in the bottom down here, mm-hmm. you can put a set screw through that, and then you actually practice with this head. And so the confidence you gain out of that versus another company out there that has something that kind of looks like the broadhead, it has somewhat of the same shape as their practice head. Well, I've taken those before and then shot the actual head, and they don't even hit even remotely close to where they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. And so the confidence you gain out of shooting the head that you're going to be trying to throw at an animal is you just can't beat that.
Okay. What retains the blades in the ferrule?
Yep. So we use a little silicone O-ring. It's not rubber. I get that question a lot because back in the day, the rubber O-rings, you'd leave them in your quiver for 6 months and all of a sudden they'd be dry rotted and wanting to be brittle. So the silicone doesn't have that aspect to it. So it holds its rigidity even through many years. So if it's going to sit in your archery equipment box for a long time, you don't have to worry about replacing that beforehand. And as soon as that hits, it'll break that band with the blades on there and open right up. So no chance of it not opening, in my opinion. People that call me and say this head can't open, I just physically don't know how it can't. If it hits an animal, it has to open. So.
And then run me through the idea between the blades. So the blades actually, so they slide back, right? You break that O-ring,
yep.
They slide back. And then once they slide back, they lock in place, right? So the
Correct.
Two blades are locked together. So they can't actually fold back any further. They can't go back in the ferrule, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those are like essentially, do you have a way to explain that? So there's basically a groove, right?
Yep. So it's called our lock and pivot. That's actually the patent that we bought from the Ulmers. Mm-hmm. So nobody else out there can do it. And I call it my anti-deflection technology. But yeah, so like Gerald was saying, that'll pop open. It'll hit a point where it locks those blades out. Mm-hmm. And then they're kind of bound together, but they are still somewhat free floating, but they can't go back inside the ferrule. And then the fact that it can pivot as well. If you hit a shoulder bone, if you're going in and that clips a shoulder bone, that blade just kind of glides out of the way. As soon as you get past it, it recorrects itself and keeps cutting through there. So like those guys that have like steep quartering shots and stuff like that. And they're like, my arrow just, I don't know if you've seen it, but where the arrow kind of goes underneath the skin and just kind of flies down the skin.
Yeah.
That's because it's deflecting off a rib versus our heads are going to not have that deflection. It's going to just kind of keep boring through there. So
I had a guy, message me probably within the last 2 weeks in regards to pivot design heads. So essentially like your guys' head where they pivot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I think you guys would say, and my experience would also suggest that it works, right? So essentially what you do is if you hit something solid, that blade's kind of pivoting, right? You're maintaining
Correct.
Force and the blade's pivoting and kind of correcting as it goes through. But this individual messaged me and basically said, like, that design is completely flawed. He's like, I actually think that pivoting blades should be outlawed. He's like, I don't. Can you wrap your head around that? Can you, like, how does this work in an animal? Like, how does your head work? I would assume my experience is that it pivots like it's supposed to. So it maintains forward momentum and it pivots, right?
So if yeah. You hit so, I mean,
solid like a rib, it pivots.
Yep. So this is on a balancing point right there in the center. Mm-hmm. So that's dead center of both blades, you know, the inch and a half, that pivot point right there. It's not going to get off balance at all. So, I mean, as that clips a bone, so you're cutting through, it's got pressure on both sides. It's going to hold that cut like that. Well, as soon as it gets more resistance, it's going to fold that blade out of the way. And then once it gets past that extra resistance, goes back to the match resistance, it's going to keep going back through.
Right.
So I don't know why somebody would say pivot blades are not good. I mean, the complaint I get from time to time is a guy will see an exit wound with, you know, one blade like that coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's just a one-sided slice going through there. Well, what's happening is as it's coming through on the exit, it's glancing a rib, it's pivoting. And so it's only exiting with one blade because it hadn't had a chance to recorrect itself.
Gotcha.
So again, that's the one complaint, but they usually end up finding the deer and it usually ends up going 20 yards. And it's like, I don't know why you're complaining that the deer's dead. Yeah. So,
yeah. So my story with severed broadheads is essentially, so 20 some years ago, 25 years ago, the first bull elk I ever killed, I shot with a Grim Reaper. I shot it with a fold back mechanical head. I was shooting a Matthews Q2 at 70 pounds, 30 inch draw. I was probably shooting 260, 250 feet per second, probably, right? And I shot him at 48 yards broadside. The bull went over and died. The very next year, I bought an over-the-counter spike tag. I went out and I hunted, and I ended up shooting a spike at 55 yards. And I mean, I say this right now because, look, I've heard this so many times, and I'm going to say it right now. Oh, I hit him right behind the shoulder. I hit him perfectly, right? And I hear this all the time.
Right in the breadbasket.
Yeah, right in the breadbasket. So I say it a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I think I hit that bull well. I don't know for sure exactly where I hit that bull, because I'm old enough and wise enough now, and I've looked at enough video of, you know, me shooting animals or other people shooting animals that swore up and down they hit it right in the breadbasket, that they didn't hit it in the breadbasket, myself included. Mm-hmm. Right. So inevitably, after that experience, I was like, oh, must have been the broadhead. You know, broadhead didn't work, right? So I went to fixed blades, and I shot fixed blades for years and years and years. And probably 4 or 5 years ago, my buddy Chris Neville was like, hey, you know, these Sever broadheads look phenomenal. I'm gonna get them, and I'm gonna try them. And I think one of the first things that he told me was, these things fly incredible. He's like, they, you know, everybody claims field point accuracy. Do you claim field point accuracy with Sever broadheads?
I do 100%. Yeah. Right. I know what you're talking about. Like, you read every broadhead package out there, and it says field point accuracy on the back of it.
It's just what,
and so it's kind of one of those marketing things. Yeah. That's like, yeah, everybody's cried wolf, so everybody just doesn't believe it anymore. Right. But I mean, we got a DM yesterday from a guy that was like, I bought one broadhead from you, and I went and double checked. He did buy just one. And he's like, I just shot it at 100 yards with my field points untuned, just slapped it on, and he's like, it was right there with it.
Right.
And he's like, I'm very impressed. So, I mean, there's a lot of guys out there that are experiencing that field point accuracy for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So Neville said to me, field point accuracy, it shoots really, really good, which to me, it makes sense. And I was hesitant because, again, you know, I'd had this experience where I lost a spike 25 years ago. And I was just like, no, I don't know, man. So I was a little bit hesitant to it. But the one thing, the one issue I was having with fixed blade heads is kind of twofold. I could always tune a fixed blade head because I've got enough intel. Like, I've worked on my own bows for long enough that, like, I could tune, and I've even said it, I wrote it in an article. I remember very specifically. I basically said, if you can't get your fixed blade broadheads to fly with your filled tips, your bow just isn't tuned. Like, you just don't know how to tune it. You just need to tune it. Right. And
yeah,
I've said that, and I had no issues over the years tuning my fixed blade heads to my filled tips. I will say at times they were for sure more finicky than a mechanical. It definitely took more work and more effort, but I felt like I could get those things to tune with my field tips. But the one thing that, like, I was struggling with is I killed a lot of animals with the fixed blade head. I never got good blood trails. I just didn't. And I didn't understand it. I was shooting a four blade. I killed a lot of animals with a four blade standard slick trick.
Okay.
And a lot of the times I would hear those animals die. I would get, you know, they wouldn't go that far. If I did have to track them, typically wasn't that far of a track job, but I was a lot of the times just literally pin dropping blood. Right. And so,
which isn't ideal.
Not ideal. I don't love it. Right. And so Neville was like, man, I think he shot one first, and I was just blown away with the blood trail. It was,
they're nasty.
So much blood.
Yeah.
Right. And so then I was like, you know what? I like the Ulmer. I'd played with it a little bit. I hadn't shot any animals with it, but I like the idea of it. I like the design. And so, you know, the improvements with the Sever being a titanium ferrule, that made sense to me. The complete design of the Sever made sense to me. So I started using them and shooting them, and I noticed, yeah, these are accurate. They're far less finicky than a fixed blade broadhead to try to tune. So I wasn't putting a whole lot of effort into, like, tuning my bow past my initial tune, right? Where I was getting good flight out of my field tips. And I was finding out that even, like, extended yardages, 80, 90, 100 yards, they were flying with my field tips was good. But the thing that really sold me was blood trails.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found that? Did they?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know why? Like,
it's the bigger cut. I mean, that's the biggest thing. And I think it's the fact that most of the time you're probably getting two holes for the most part. Like even like I know you were telling me about that antelope you went end to end on. Yeah. Like you almost put two holes in that thing. And so I think that's the big thing, but I'd say it's just that bigger cut than a, you know, a 1-inch fixed blade going through there is not going to have as much blood coming out as a, you know, you'd probably run in the 1.5 inches or.
Yeah. So I shot four blades a lot. So I shot a four blade slick trick a lot. The standard slick
but
trick,
the,
which is one
for
one
the inch. Sever.
Oh, the sever. I shoot 1.5 inches, the titanium.
1.5 inches.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so get a little bit more cut out of it. That's my only guess with it. I mean, the hybrid, if you were running the hybrid, that would make a lot of sense. Cause we've been, the blood trails we've been seeing out of that are even 10 times what we saw out of the standard 1.5 and 1.75. So it's been insane this year.
That was one of the biggest selling points for me, to be honest, was
the blood. Yeah.
Yeah. Blood trails. I always wanted to, I wanted a blood trail that was like you see on videos where guys, it's just like a, you know, a carpet that you can follow it at a walking pace.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had that.
Yeah. And it's nice. It's that confidence you get when you walk up, because I usually walk up to first blood and then I'll sit there for 45 minutes to an hour. But when you can see blood going up into the trees, you're like, okay, yeah, that thing's probably dead up there. But this thing, it kind of brings some ease to your mind for sure.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, larger cutting diameter, so 1.5 inches. And then you guys also make 2 inches, right? For maybe guys that are hunting whitetail back east. I assume those are probably pretty popular.
Yep.
Which
we still have a lot of guys running 2 inch for elk, which is shocking. But we still get guys that send pictures in that are like, yep, shot this at 75 yards, the 2 inch complete pass through.
Yeah.
It's like, I wouldn't do that, but
sure.
I mean, more power to you.
What's your go-to head for elk?
I like the 1.5 inches. And that was even before I worked here. Like I used to run when I ran a mechanical, I've gone back and forth on the whole, you need to shoot a fixed blade for elk. Mm-hmm. I used to fall into that trap and same experience. I got crappy blood trail on a bull. I hit, spent 4 hours tracking a bull 250 yards, which was ridiculous in my opinion. But I like the 1.5 inches just because elk's rib gappings are 1.75 to 2 inches typically. I don't know. It's just the anatomy of them. Some old biologist told me about this. And so the fact that 1.5 inches head with our lock and pivot can snake through ribs easier versus a 2 inch. If you accidentally just, again, my prepper mentality, if you square up on those ribs, you're going to lose a lot of energy with a 2 inch head. Mm-hmm. And so I like the 1.5 inches just because it, again, if I clip a rib, I'm always going to make sure I'm going to get through those ribs.
Do you like the hybrid?
I do. Yeah, that's what I shot this bull right here with this last year. Just did absolute work on him. I frontal shot, I buried a 28.5 or 28-inch arrow all the way up to the nock in him. And the blood trail on that one was absolutely insane. But I think most frontal shots are crazy blood trails. So
yeah. Yeah, I mean I shot an elk frontal and it went in his chest and the arrow was buried in his back hip.
With a 1.5 sever?
Yeah. With a 1.5 sever. And then we were talking when we were in Salt Lake, but I shot an antelope in Colorado. I shot him in the chest end to end. So entry into the chest and it came out his rear end. So
yeah,
like complete pass through the long way.
Yeah.
So I haven't had any personal issues with penetration. I've shot bulls. I shot a bull in Colorado, 65 yards quartering away, went in kind of mid rib and buried in his off shoulder. I don't think that a fixed blade head would have done any different. I think it would have buried in the off shoulder. That bull died. I killed another bull complete pass through at 50 yards. Everything I've shot with one for the most part has just been, you know, two holes or at least one hole that was more than ample. And like I said, the crazy thing is I just had such amazing blood trails with your broadheads. So just keep me believing. And then to go along with that, it's like, to me, the there's the added benefit. Like I feel like I can shoot a lower profile vein. So I can shoot a four fletch, you know, a 23 AAE air razor, or I can shoot a boning heat vein in a four fletch configuration, which is a lower profile, stiffer vein. I feel like I don't need quite as much, you know, guidance as I would with like a big fixed blade, which I think is another added benefit.
Yeah, like I when I used to shoot fixed blades, it was sitting there and trying to index your broadheads and get the fletchings to line up just right. And like I don't have to really do anything with these. Like I said, I usually just unscrew a field point, slap it on, and it's hitting right where I want it to. So that's the confidence, which I think confidence is 95% of bow hunting, in my opinion. If you don't have confidence in your equipment, you're not going to hit anything. So.
Let's have this. I want to ask you a question. So, what's more important to you, accuracy or penetration?
Accuracy by a long shot. By a long shot.
Accuracy first.
Yeah. Because it's just, if you're not hitting where you're aiming, like, what's the point of hitting it anyways? You know, like, that's my whole thing is that, like, for my elk, for example, this year, when he came at me, he was 30 yards and I'd never taken a frontal shot before. And the confidence I had because I'd shot this hybrid hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times back at Easton, you know, at 50, 60, 70 yards. And I had a hole about this big at 30 yards that his throat was sitting in. And I was like, at full draw, sitting there contemplating if I should make the shot. And I was like, no, you can do this. So like I had the confidence, you know, of accuracy. So I just centered that pin in the middle of that basketball size hole and let her eat, you know? So again, back to my point, accuracy is everything.
And I ideally you get both, right? You want both.
Exactly.
But to the point, the reason I asked the question is I think people, I talk to a lot of people that are like, they want to build this setup that they want to maximize penetration. Like they talk so much about penetration. They want a high FOC. They want a heavy arrow. They want to cut on contact, fixed blade broadhead because they just want to maximize penetration. And I understand that and I get it. But to me, if you're giving up, if you're sacrificing even like a little bit of accuracy or forgiveness to do that, I think you're doing yourself a disservice because I feel like you can build an arrow with a broadhead like a Sever, which I feel is more forgiving. I think it's more accurate. And I don't think you're giving up nearly as much in penetration as you might be in accuracy if you went the other direction.
Yeah, and people think that mechanicals are just energy suckers, and they're really not. You know, like everybody I've talked to that's been shooting their heads, like I see some ridiculous pass-throughs. And the fact that we're getting guys blowing through deer at 95, 100 yards is pretty dang impressive. And speaking for the, you know, the penetration aspect of it, you're not giving up any penetration on it.
Yeah, I'd
So.
rather I mean, and whether it is or isn't is debatable, but like I would rather have one hole in the perfect spot than two holes in an area that's not perfect.
Yeah.
Do you know what I
My
mean? I'd rather
I
have
had a
one
buddy.
hole in the lungs versus two in the guts.
Yep. I th this is kind of a random story, but I had a buddy going back to accuracy, up hunting the Wasatch up here on the extended. Had a squirrel arrow in the back of his back of his quiver. It was just a field point. And buck came past and he accidentally grabbed that field point arrow. Shot this buck and he's like smoked it. He said it went 50 yards, piled up, and he's like going down there. There's like no blood trail. And he got to his arrow and it was the field point, but he punched a hole right through its heart. And so he was
Really?
because he was so accurate, I mean still killed it. Don't not
Sure.
promoting shooting stuff with a
Sure.
field point, but
Yeah.
again, going back to the accuracy points, he put a field point in the right spot and it killed it. So
Yeah. I think it's finding that middle ground, right? And to me, I would rather build, you know, if I get an inch and a half cutting diameter out of a Sever broadhead, I don't feel like I'm giving up that much in penetration. I do feel like it's more accurate and it's more forgiving, especially if you're in like a hunting situation where you can be a little bit torquey. Your body position isn't in the exact position that it would be when I'm up at my local range shooting arrows. I just think like that's an advantage, like a trade I'm willing to make. And I don't know that I'm necessarily really giving up a ton in penetration.
No, I don't think so. I mean, all the examples you have firsthand proof that you don't lack penetration. If you're going end to end on antelope, I mean, that's saying something right there. So,
And then, I mean, to me, like the bigger test is like on an elk, right? I haven't really had
yeah.
any issues necessarily with penetration. And I'm like you, it doesn't make sense to me how a broadhead in a mechanical like yours could fail. Those blades have to open.
They have to, unless the practice screws in, which I've seen that a handful of times.
Really?
Yeah, I had a guy wanting to sue us last year. He's like, your head didn't open. I can't open it with a pair of pliers. And I was like, can you send me a picture of the head? And so he sent me a picture, and sure enough, the black little set screw is in there.
No
and
kidding.
I replied to him. I was like, "Hey, your set screw's in there," and he never replied back. So, that's the only time I've ever had one like legitimately not open up.
Wow.
Because it can't. Yeah. So,
do you replace your blades if you put the locking screw in and you're practicing with that broadhead? Do you still go back through and replace your blades before you go hunting with that?
I do. I just. Mm-hmm. Again, that kind of fail safe thing. Cause when you're taking that thing that's unmovable and you're hitting the target that's unmovable, it's eventually going to give out over time. And so what it does is it'll weaken those ears after, 20 to 30 shots.
Gotcha.
And so for me, I'd rather have something not fail. So I just take it 2 seconds and, replace the blades on it. Yeah. And I only dedicate one or two heads to practicing with. I know guys that'll beat their whole lineup up, but it's just why they all fly the same anyways.
True.
So,
Yeah, and they're pretty easy to change out. And I know that you guys sell blades, right? You can replace, mm-hmm. you can buy just blades.
Yep. So for $18, you can replace 3 full heads. Mm-hmm. So, like, cool story from Expo. I had a guy Thursday morning. I don't know if I told you this up there, but a guy Thursday morning came running over. I mean, it was like 10:02. He was at our booth, and he's like, "I just wanted to show you this. I went to Africa this last year," and so he took one hybrid head down, and he took, I think, 5 packs of blades with him. And his whole thing is, he's like, "I wanted to see how many animals I could shoot with one head without it breaking." Hmm. And he ended up getting to 9 animals before the ferrule slightly bent. But I mean, he's like, "Here's the first one." And then he'd show me and he's like, "I replaced the blades. Here's the second one. Here's the blood trail." And so that was kind of cool that he was able to shoot 9 different animals by just changing the blades out.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So
same head, huh?
Same head, same little hybrid head. And at the end he had a little picture and it was, the head kind of with the tip slightly bent. He's like, "I drilled a shoulder at like 10 yards or something like that. And it just slightly folded the tip, but it was just a pile of blades and the one head sitting there." He's like, "Yep, that thing killed 9 of those animals."
Yeah. I always retire mine. If I shoot it with it, I feel like it's done its job. So I just kind of retire it. Sometimes I'll shoot it for practice.
I'm the same way. I retire arrows and the broadhead, and it usually ends up sitting with the animal or something like that. So. Yeah.
Right on. So what else do you guys have? I don't know if you can talk. Do you have anything new and exciting you want to tell us about, or is it kind of a wait and see?
Kind of a wait and see. I gave you one. So, yeah. Or I gave you a couple.
I just wanted to know if you want to talk about it, or if you want to do a wait and see.
No, we'll hold off, okay. But we'll keep the excitement going. I think all I can say is if there's any whitetail hunters or antelope hunters, I think what we got coming in June, you guys are going to really like. Okay. So
June.
June. Yep. June, Michigan TAC. So the Crystal Springs, Total Archery Challenge. We're going to be doing a kind of a first grab up there. And then the next week we'll have a launch on their website. So.
Very cool. What are you shooting this year for bow, hunting bow setup, and what kind of hunt plans going on for the year?
So I'm kind of weird. This is like the first time. So for years at Shields, I'd pick up a new bow every year, like when November 10th or whatever Matthew's release date was, I'd be on the phone with my rep, putting an order in and getting a new bow. But when I left, I picked up a Hoyt right before I left. Mm-hmm. And I've ran that the last 2 years. And I think I'm going to run it again this year. I just shoot it so freaking well. Like, it's one of the few bows that I have perfectly set up. I've got a black gold mountain light sight on there. I've got the six arrow quiver on it. Front and back bar, I run a 10 and an 8. And I just can drive with that thing. Like, it's a 31-inch, the VTM 31. Mm-hmm. And I traditionally couldn't shoot short bows very well. But for some reason, this one, me and it just agree. So I think I'm just going to run it one more year, especially with the wedding. My fiance probably wouldn't be super stoked if I was dropping, $1,200 on a new bow or something like that. So
tell her, hey, this would be a great wedding gift for you from you.
Exactly. But as far as hunts go, we've got, we do a Uintah's elk hunt every year.
Gotcha.
So it's low success, but I finally gotten to the point where I kind of have it somewhat figured out, and we usually get into elk every year. Mm-hmm. So me and 3 buddies are going to run up there and I just actually booked the goats yesterday. So we're picking up goats to run up in there and try to get 9 or 10 miles in and see what we can find. So
that's fun. You got a deer tag there or no?
I'm actually going to do deer. Probably I've been looking at it on the Insider actually quite a bit. Cause I don't have any points. I just drew a tag last year. So I'm trying to find a spot, cause there's a kid who just got into hunting at Easton. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to find a spot that I can take him and like do like the full, 4 or 5 day like actual hunting experience with him. instead of just running up the Wasatch and trying to shoot a 2-point off the trail or something like that. So,
right.
But not a whole lot this year, just with the wedding. But next year I've got enough points to do Colorado.
Nice.
And then I think Colorado elk. And then the year after that, I should have enough for Colorado deer. So
right on.
But
that's the thing, playing the game. You just gotta.
Oh yeah, no. Insider definitely helps with that.
Yeah.
Because I probably spend a little too much time at work. My boss is listening.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's this time of year, man. It's all you just gotta get hooked into it. You start getting a thought, and you're like, oh, I wonder what that unit, how many points that takes, or what that looks like. So
it's so funny. Like this year, going into this year in December, so I logged into Idaho, tried to buy a tag. I had a buddy that actually went up there, stood in line. He messaged me and was like, hey, you know, I'm here. I'm only buying for myself. It probably wouldn't be that big of a deal. The line's not too crazy, you know, if I bought you a tag. And so I bought an elk tag through him. And it was kind of like looking for me like a year. I was like, man, I really don't know what I'm going to be doing this year. Like I'm going to have to kind of get scrappy about it. And then like all of a sudden, man, it's just like, I got more tags than I know what to do with, like, already. And there's still so many draws still to come, you know? So it's like, I should get an opportunity this year to run a sever into a bunch of different animals. So I should have a full report on how they did. Yeah. This year, because it's filling up pretty quick, and we should have a good,
It goes, man. It's always like when you don't expect it, and then all of a sudden the floodgates open and your plate's full.
Kind of fun, man. I found out yesterday. So Arizona's draw results actually posted, and I drew a late season archery elk tag. So me and Chris Neville, my buddy.
Nice.
Yeah, we're going to go down and do a late archery hunt. And then my 12-year-old, he just got through Hunter's Ed this year. Like, I was kind of dragging my feet on getting him through Hunter's Ed. And then I got him through Hunter's Ed, and I applied him in Arizona for an elk tag. And he drew a late rifle tag in the same units that I have.
Really?
So, yeah. First year applying. What,
so. Is it like back-to-back weeks, or is it?
Back-to-back days. So mine ends the 27th of November, and his opens the 28th of November.
That's actually not a bad deal, though.
Oh, it's going to work out amazing.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to give my boss the bad news that September and then November is going to be pretty gnarly for me. But
luckily, your boss is probably pretty cool with you going and doing that stuff.
Yeah, they seem to. Yeah. So
that's what's fun about being in the industry is, like, this year, you know, or last year, I just started and I didn't have a lot of PTO. And my boss was like,
"Right,
you've got to go elk hunt. Like, just go do it." You know, so he's like, "Don't go crazy with it, but take your week that you always do and." They go try to shoot a bull. So
yeah, you got to test product.
They just get it. Yep. They just get it. That's the nice part about being in the industry.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. You don't have to argue with, you know, a boss that doesn't hunt, that doesn't understand the role that it plays in your life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No. Sure. So
we'll have to catch up. I'll be interested to see how you do. And, I'll be in touch and I'll make sure that I document a little bit better some results for you guys, because I'm super excited.
You've got some testers. So
yeah, we're going to run them through some animals this year.
I'm excited for it.
And see how it does. Tell people before I cut you loose, how do people buy Sever broadheads or products? What else do you guys offer? And then, you know, anything that you want to plug, like if you're into social media and you want to plug yourself, go ahead and let people know where they can follow you.
For sure. So yeah, you can go to severbroadheads.com. That's where most of our sales are at. With coming from a shop, I believe in shops. So I have opened up a few kind of select shops across, just small mom and pop. That's the ones I kind of like to support. So like Kyle Douglas up in north. So anybody's up in northern Utah, Douglas Archery has them in stock. People down in Texas, I've got them in Houston. West Houston Archery. So a few shops here and there, but primarily online is where you're going to be able to find it. The big thing we're trying to push this year that we're trying to roll with is that target. I know you just got one.
Yeah.
Archery target, super durable. So
I bought another one from you guys probably 2 years ago, and it's just at a point where I've shot every angle you can possibly manage. It'll still have an arrow, but it's getting to the point where it needs to be retired. It's pretty gnarly.
Yeah. And you put the arrows into them, and you're not like the average person where we're shooting 50 arrows a week, you know?
I've put, I would say since probably about the 1st of December, I've probably put 100 to 200 arrows a day into it.
That's fair. That's a lot.
And it's a great target for a great price.
Yeah. Yep. Can't beat that. And then if you want to follow my personal social account, which I don't usually post anything unless I kill something, it's just Bowhunter Casey. So Casey, just two letters at the end, but nothing too crazy. So
yeah. The other thing we didn't even know that I wanted to, I love the fact that you guys allow people to buy broadheads in the number that they want. So if they want to buy one, they can buy one. Mm-hmm. If they want to buy 20, they can buy 20.
Yep. And plug a code for this. So if there is anybody listening that wants to try just one, typically our website offer does $7.99 shipping. If you put in code SEVER free ship, all one word, you can get free shipping on that, and you just pay for the single head without shipping. So anybody wants to just try it, put it in practice lock, see how it flies, that's the best way to do it.
Right on. Well, I appreciate your time today. I can't wait to get out in the field. This time of year, I'm just jonesing to get out. So
I can't wait
to get out, and I look forward to catching up to you later in the year and find out how you did. And hopefully we'll be able to swap some stories and some results from some new product.
For sure. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah. Thanks, Casey. Have a good day.